Now, our next guest says that conservative political parties have acted as a hinge for democracy over the decades. He's looked back at politics in pre-World War II Germany, Britain in the early 1900s, and many other countries in Europe. He says the way conservative parties respond to far-right groups outside and within their own parties can determine a lot of the time just how stable a democracy is.
In current day terms, we'll find out how today's Republican Party in the U.S. lines up with this pattern and what it could mean for democracy. Also, how countries like France and Britain have responded in recent months. Daniel Zilblatt's a professor of government at Harvard University. He's the author of the new book, Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Yeah, great. Thank you for having me.
Well, Daniel, why do you think of conservative parties, as you say, a hinge that democracy swings on when you look back at history?
Yeah, so I have been studying the history of democracy in late 19th century Europe into the 20th century, you know, rocky period in Europe and democracy's history. And normally when we think about democracy, we tend to think of the people pushing for democracy. So in the historical context, it was often social democrats or liberals and forces often from the left. But one of the things that hasn't really been studied sufficiently, I think, is how conservatives, as the kind of defenders of the regime incumbents, responded to these pressures. And I think the different ways they responded, in fact, shaped how democracy looked.
Can you walk us through a couple examples of how conservative parties have responded?
Yeah, so, you know, in the 19th century, there was this one of the big pressures of democratic changes was suffrage expansion, and conservatives were often opposed to this because they were representing landed elites, aristocrats, powerful groups who thought they would lose out in the face of democracy. And so as the expansion of suffrage took place, one of the big things was how conservatives would respond to this. Would they concede democratic reforms? And I studied one guy just as an example, Lord Salisbury, who was the most powerful conservative in 19th century Britain. He was really opposed to suffrage reform, and he had this wonderful quote where he said, "Democracy is the right of eight beggars to govern seven Rothschilds." But as the century went along, he kind of slowly discovered actually if he built up party organization, he could compete and sometimes win. And so that discovery was an important development, I think, in European democracy.
And so that example features a strong conservative party. It sounds like from your telling of it that the conservatives were on the ground listening, wanting to know what people wanted, honing their case. So to look at a contrasting example, Germany,
yeah,
circa 1919.
Yeah, Germany was, I mean, I really think of these two examples of Great Britain in the 19th century and Germany as two kind of polar opposite cases that tell us a lot. So in Germany, you had a similar group of aristocrats and landed elites, so again, the most powerful groups in that country's society in the late 19th century. And rather than, you know, they tried to build party organizations, and kind of a complicated story about why they weren't able to develop party organizations. So we think of party organization as, and political parties as something that was always there throughout history, but that's really not the case. And in 19th century German conservatives had a real a difficult time building up parties for themselves. And as a result of that, they were very panicked in the face of democracy and were much more resistant to it.
And did that, are you making the case that that paved the way for the rise of Hitler?
Yeah, in many ways. I mean, it's not a direct road, but it certainly played a major role. I mean, so in the late 19th century, there was this incredible moment in the 1890s where the German conservatives had a party congress. It was a very loose organization, and this group of anti-Semitic activists showed up at the party convention, and nobody was checking IDs at the door. It was a really loosely organized party, and they voted to include an anti-Semitic plank in the Conservative Party platform against the wishes of the party leaders. So this is the first time in German history that you had anti-Semitism at such a high-profile level in a political party, and this really, you know, began a process that then really exploded in the Weimar period in the 1920s and 30s.
And getting at that idea of a political party, you say a stronger party, in this case a stronger conservative party, benefits and strengthens democracy. Can you unpack that a little? Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting kind of argument because it's provocative. A lot of people think, well, these are the historically and maybe today, if depending on what side of the aisle you're on, you might think these are the opponents of democracy. How can conservatives help democracy? And I think I came to this as a study of history, and not really thinking about the partisan implications of it, but the point is that that groups on the right are always there. The question is, how do they get organized? How do they organize themselves? And when you don't have a robust constitutional center-right party present, as Germany didn't, for instance, in the 1890s or in the 1920s, 1930s, there's a vacuum, and that vacuum gets filled by much more radical right forces. And so in that sense, conservative center-right parties are a precondition for democratic stability, because without them there, the options are only much worse.
I want to fast forward now and look at the U.S. presidential election, which put out a huge roster of would-be Republican candidates. Donald Trump then seen as a fringe candidate at the beginning of the election season. So how did the Conservative Party respond to him within this framework that you're talking about and also to populist movements?
Yeah, so it's my book that I've written is really a historical study, and the name Donald Trump doesn't appear in the book, but, you know, there's a lot of people have read the book and contacted me and said this seems to be a parable for our times. And I think what people see, and I see the resonance, is that when a party of the right is fractured and has lost control over the selection of candidates, lost control over campaign expenditures, that all of this, in a way, kind of opens the door for much more grassroots radical right forces. And so in many ways, I think when we look at the presidential election of 2016 in particular, I think really the big issue was who won the Republican nomination. Because once a Republican was, once you had the Republican candidate, there's almost a 50-50 chance of who's going to win the election. So the real issue was who won the Republican nomination. In this case, I really think that there's been decades, the Republican Party for decades has been hollowed out, I would say, by outside expenditures. The party has lost control over the nomination process in the sense that you have party leaders being primaried by, Tea Party groups and so on. And so the party, in some sense, is a kind of, sort of a bit of a rotten door, and Donald Trump came walking through the door once the party had sort of begun to disintegrate. So although the party is very strong in the sense that it's in power across all branches of government, organizationally, I think it's quite weak.
We're talking with Daniel Zilblatt right now, professor of government at Harvard University, and he's the author of the new book, Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. And he says throughout the course of history, weak conservative parties have been a threat to democracy. And you use the term, and I've seen you use this before, hollowed out, to describe the Republican Party of today. So I guess the question then is, if we continue on with your thesis, what comes next?
Yeah, it's really hard to know. I mean, the countries that I studied in my book were, again, Britain and Germany, as well as the rest of Western Europe. And Germany is this case, a country where there was this weak center-right, and this paved the way for the rise of Hitler. I think there's really no question about that. And this problem was really kind of overcome through World War II, unfortunately. I mean, that's in some ways the way that this problem was solved in German history. You know, there's been a split on the right in Germany between Catholics and Protestants. There had never been a party that encompassed both Catholics and Protestants, and it was only after World War II that you have the German CDU, Merkel's party, that was founded as a cross-confessional party, that the party of strong party of the center-right was formed. So, what are the implications for today for the United States? I'm not suggesting that we want a war. I mean, especially in the current climate, I mean, that's something that's, I mean, clearly this is in the news, but this is not at all what I think, has to happen. I mean, what has to happen is there needs to be organizational reforms within the Republican Party. One interesting thing to think about is, and other people have made this point, that the Republican Party doesn't have superdelegates in the same way the Democratic Party does. And so, there's people in the Democratic Party who are critical of that for the Democratic Party. But I think it turns out, had there been superdelegates in the Republican Party in 2015, 2016, Donald Trump wouldn't be president today. So this is a way in which I think political parties don't always necessarily have to be organized democratically. And again, that's a provocative kind of point, but a hierarchical political party may be a precondition of national democracy, in fact.
And you're talking about the role of strong political party organizations, but in the age of social media and that more direct participation in politics that it can give, can parties, do you think, rebuild themselves to be as strong as they used to be when sort of the nature of social media is that the voices are more plentiful, but they're also more diffuse?
Yeah, no, I think that's in some ways the biggest challenge that we confront. I mean, so we can think of technological changes. There's a whole series of forces that are conspiring against strong political parties today. Technological changes, and so, political parties don't have a monopoly on media by any means because of social media. I think increased economic inequality means any candidate for office can have their own private billionaire to pay for the candidacy. They don't need to rely on party coffers. And laws around campaign finance certainly exacerbate that. You know, the openness of outside funding for candidates exacerbates that. And then also just the mechanisms by which parties select their candidates. So these are three things that make strong parties difficult. You know, I guess the point I would make is that this is, if we're looking for areas for how to reform our democracy, this is something I'm a partisan for parties. I think parties are a precondition for democracy, strong parties on the left and the right. And so we should be thinking about ways of strengthening parties.
Daniel Zilblatt is going to stay with us now. He's a professor of government at Harvard University. He's got a new book. It's called Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. And he says that looking at the course of history, weak conservative parties have been a destabilizing force for democracy.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you think that politics needs strong political parties, conservative or otherwise? Do you think that the Democratic and Republican Party organizations need to be stronger? Did the Republican Party in particular in the U.S. go too far to accommodate Donald Trump? How did supporting Donald Trump affect the party? What do you make the relationship between Republicans and more far-right movements? And if you follow elections in Europe and elsewhere around the world, what do you see going on there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll continue our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Daniel Zilblatt is with us. He's a professor of government at Harvard University and the author of the book Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. And he says that throughout the course of history, strong conservative parties favor democracy.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions for our guest. What do you make of the rift? A conservative movement, conservatives in the Republican Party, not comfortable necessarily with the rise of Donald Trump. What do you make of the relationship between the Republican Party, Donald Trump, and supporters of the president further to the right of the mainstream Republican Party? Do you agree with our guest that we should have strong party organizations that play a strong role in doing things like funding campaigns, recruiting and picking candidates? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Let's go to our first caller. Now we've got Jim joining us first in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, I appreciate the professor's theorem concerning European politics, but I don't think it applies to ours. Between 1776 and 1865, there were strong center-right conservative parties in this country, but there was no democracy. We had slavery. And between 1865 and 1965, we had conservative center-right parties, and there was no democracy south of the Mason-Dixon line. It wasn't until the assassination of President Kennedy and the halo effect of his death that President Johnson finally got democracy in the United States that only really took place in 1965. So I think this thesis about the value or the effect of center-right parties on democracy did not apply in the United States of America until 1965.
All right, Jim, thank you for that call. And Daniel, I know that your book, you said, doesn't even mention Donald Trump in the politics of the day, but can you extrapolate? Do you want to take that on?
Yeah, no, that's. I think the caller's points are very good ones. I take the point that the U.S. wasn't democratic really until 1965, and efforts at expansion of suffrage in the U.S. South after the Civil War failed and were defeated, and so you know the U.S. was not fully democratic. I guess a couple of thoughts. One, I would say that the big dynamic of what I'm looking at is really is an industrial era dynamic, and so the emergence of a divide between working class movements and property-owning groups. And so it's a theory that really applies to mostly to late 19th century, early 20th century. So I don't really think one can use it to try to understand a kind of agricultural society, you know, as the U.S. was in the first part of the 19th century. But, you know, since the 1960s, I would say that, you know, the challenges to contemporary American democracy come from a right wing that doesn't basically accept the to some degree, I mean, certain elements in it don't accept the basic rules of the democratic game. And so I think the current challenges to democracy certainly can be understood through this lens. And the growth of democracy, in fact, I think after 1945 through the 1960s, came in part because of a moderate Republican Party. And, you know, there was a kind of bipartisan cooperation on the Civil Rights Bill, Voting Rights Acts, where you had Northeastern liberal Republicans and Democrats, liberal Democrats cooperating. You had Southern Democrats, conservative Democrats fighting against this. And so it was the presence and the availability of a moderate center-right that, in fact, helped the U.S. democratize in the 1960s. So, you know, that's sort of an era that has gone past us now, and you now have two very polarized camps, and it's much more difficult. I think, you know, we're currently suffering the consequences of that. I mean, that's, as I said, this is not, you know, this is not the subject of the book, but this is an implication that I kind of draw out of it, or a lens through which I think we can understand American history.
And Daniela, dig back a little on your answer. You said, I think, that the far-right strand of the Conservative Party doesn't observe the rules of the democratic game always, such as what kind of rules are you talking about?
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, a basic democratic norm is to accept the opposition as legitimate. And so I think it's critical that both, in order for democracy to survive, you know, what this means is that you may disagree with with the opposition, but you think they have a right to exist and to compete for power. And so, you know, this has been a main part of American democracies, the American political system, since the beginning of the 19th century. I mean, it was actually very difficult to establish this principle in the early days. But I think today, you know, when we see, you know, the birther movement and so on in the U.S., where the kind of sitting president, his citizenship was being challenged, you know, based really on complete rumors and ungrounded rumors. I mean, these were kind of indirect sort of attacks on the basic legitimacy of an elected president to govern. I don't want to say, you know, that only one side is vulnerable to this kind of problem. I think there's also on the left, there may be efforts to kind of criticize Republicans and Donald Trump for, you know, he won an election, and that's, you know, we have to accept the results. But there's people, I think, on both sides who challenge each other's right to exist. So that's what I mean, in a sense, a challenge to democratic norms. And in the U.S., in recent years, this has been a greater challenge for the right, I think.
I want to take another caller. Let's see. We've got Chris next in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'm calling because I really think it's a fascinating topic. I really like this political stuff. I was wondering, you know, the guest is looking at the effects of conservatives and center-right parties and how their strength helps democracy. I was wondering if anyone has ever looked at whether center-left parties or a strong center-left party also strengthens or has other effects on democracy.
All right, Chris, thanks. Daniel.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It turns out that a lot of the historical work, I mean, I could recommend books and so on, there's a lot of historical work that emphasizes this, because historically, anyway, in Europe, I mean, which, again, is the focus of my study, the rise of suffrage, expansion of suffrage for male suffrage as well as female suffrage, but especially male suffrage, really came on the shoulders of labor movements and socialist parties that demanded this. And so democracy came really through struggles from the left, often with ambivalent perceived. The European liberals were kind of in the middle of the road, and in some sense often were ideologically sympathetic to it, but then when it came down to it, the idea of giving workers the right to vote was a challenge to some of the to 19th century European liberals. Conservatives were really the opponents of this process, and so I think the main thrust of the historical work really says that the left were the kind of main proponents and advocates and heroes of the story. And in some ways, what my work is doing is to fill in the other side of the story, which is, it's sort of been treated as a black box. We don't really know what the right was doing in response to these movements.
And Daniel, can we take stock now of some of the politics in the rest of the world, some of the populist movements that we've seen rising, and also the conservative parties? If you look at France, that was maybe a surprise upset with Macron winning,
yes,
instead of Le Pen. What do you see happening there?
Yeah, so it's the French presidential election is fascinating. I mean, you do have a kind of collapse of political parties there, you know, where the socialists and the two main parties historically over the last 30 years have been the socialists on the left and the Republican Party on the right. And in the final round of the two-round election in France in last spring, or this spring rather, they're neither of these parties were represented. And so it's really a challenge to existing political parties. I mean, the way I think about this, though, I mean, so the final round, I mean, it was really people, you know, we kind of forget this now, but as in May 2017, Marine Le Pen, a populist right party, anti-immigrant party, you know, with lots of overlap with Donald Trump's program, was the candidate against Manuel Macron in the final round. And the, you know, one of the key questions was what would Francois Fillon, who was the leader of the Republican Party, so the main center-right party, who would he endorse? In some ways, he's ideologically closer, one might say, to Le Pen than to socialists. But at the end of the day, he endorsed Macron. And I've looked at voter analyses, and lots of voters who voted for the center-right flowed to Macron in the final round. So what all of this means is that, I think it's really instructive if we compare the U.S. to France, the two presidential elections. The center-right in France abandoned the far-right and endorsed a candidate who had been in a socialist government. In the U.S., the center-right endorsed, of course, because this was their candidate for president, the Trump candidacy for president, and Trump won. So I think here you see really the pivotal role that the center-right can play.
Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
That was Daniel Zilblatt, professor of government at Harvard University. His book is called Conservative Parties and the Birth of Democracy. He was with us to talk about why he says conservative parties are a hinge for democracy and what that says about today's political climate.